FNR, Football Nation Radio. The Journos, with Carlos Alberto Diego and The Age's Michael Lynch on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome everyone, streaming football 24-7, you're on FNR Football Nation Radio, Australia's first and only 24-hour radio station dedicated to the beautiful, beautiful game of football. I'm Carlos Alberto Diego. Don't forget, in this hour, you can join us anytime on our talkback line and win a big traditional premium pack panettone from our great friends there at Ital. All you need to do is give us a ring on 9944 9999, that's 9944 9999, 03 in front of that if you're outside Victoria, plus 613 if you're overseas. SMS us also your thoughts and comments on 0428 933 345. This is the Journos Hour, Tuesday edition, and of course every Tuesday we've got the legendary Michael Lynch from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald joining us. Good morning to you, Lynchy.
Good morning. Yes, legendary, perhaps in my own lunchtime.
No, in my mind, Lynchy, I've read every article from you since we started doing community radio back in 1993, Lynchy. So, you're past the test of the legendary status as far as we're concerned. And for that, I'm going to give you a Ital panettone when I see you next. Too.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm very, very keen on panettone.
I know you'd have a lot of Italian friends that you'd be sharing a lot of panettone with over the years, mate. And, of course, it's World Cup draw time, and no doubt a lot of the Italian friends probably wouldn't be talking too much about it because they're not over there. But, of course, Australia drew France, Denmark and Peru. You've been to a million of these things, Lynchy. You've reported on heaps of World Cups. It's not so scary for Australians this time round, is it?
Which doesn't look as bad as 2014, no. Funnily enough, I actually have never been to a World Cup draw. They tend to be the province of journalists on freebies, and we've never actually been offered a freebie to a World Cup draw. So I can't actually speak for the glitz and glamour of the ballroom and the auditorium where the balls are shaken. But World Cups, yeah, I've been to several now, and they're always fantastic sort of experiences. You know, obviously, I think a lot of the listeners here will be very keen football fans, and I suspect many of them have followed Australia on their travels since 2006, so they'll know exactly what I mean. You sort of do live in a sort of football bubble for a month, but it's the bubble that's kind of close. Like a lovely bubble bath, you know.
Of course, when you talk about the bubble bath, I don't know where we're going to be washed and thoroughly scrubbed, but we're playing France in the first game. And look, you know, on paper, we've no chance. And of course, France, I think Eric Bortiac, the import for Brisbane Roar, said they're light years ahead of us in technique and where they are with their football. But it is the first game of a World Cup, Lynchy. It's, you know, it's not sudden death by way of the tournament, but it's actually the one-off against a really good team. They're going there to win the World Cup, and my view is, you know, they might be a little bit underdone in that first game. What are your
I don't know. You're not talking about Italy now, you know, the team that traditionally starts very slowly and gets better. Les Bleus, well, of course they are better on paper, yeah, but, you know, football's not played on paper, as everybody's ever talked about the game acknowledges. And of course they should beat Australia, but, you know, they were technically superior to Senegal in the first game in 2002, and we all know what happened there, didn't we? Papa Bouba Diouf, I think, was it, who scored? Or
Alhaji Diouf?
Alhaji Diouf, sorry, not Papa Bouba.
They're playing in the same team. So
yeah,
there's a couple of them.
I get my Diouf's mixed up there. But look, you know, they were superior there. I think they lost to Denmark as well in that World Cup too, in the group phase. And they went there as world champions. And we all know they imploded apocalyptically in South Africa as well in 2010. I'm not suggesting any of that's going to happen, but, you know, they were technically and all that superior to Albania in the Euros, but they took all day to beat them, didn't they? Only 1-0.
Yeah.
They lost to a much inferior Portuguese team. in the final. So, you know, I'm not suggesting Australia are going to beat them, but it shouldn't be outside the scope of their ambition to clog it up and try and get a draw, you know?
Yeah, well, the thing is, the clogging up part of it is going to be interesting because that'll depend on the coach, won't it? Because it
clog the midfield and the forward, press from the front, take the game to them, don't allow them to settle, of course.
Yeah, no, well, I'm thinking clogging up sometimes can be viewed as you know, stacking the back line and parking the bus and then getting them on the break, which is
well,
not something...
It doesn't have to be. It can be flooding the midfield, clogging things up there, getting them pressing hard and energetically from the front, you know. Yeah. But you've also got to have super fit players to do that because you need to drop into a back five or six pronto when you haven't got the ball. But, yeah, look, a lot of the tactics against Les Bleus are going to depend on who the coach is. The other games, well, you'd have to say, you know, Australia would have to think they could win those. I mean, the best-case scenario for Australia, don't laugh when I say this, is 7 points.
Mm.
A draw against France and 2 wins. The most likely outcome, I think, is a loss to France and then either 2 draws, 1 win and a loss or, you know, it's between 2 and 4 points probably is what's going to happen.
And Denmark's really interesting because obviously they finished second in their group. Poland... qualified directly. They were in pot one in for the draw, but Denmark beat Poland 4-0 at home, and then they defeated in the playoffs Republic of Ireland 5-1 away to really clinch that in a dominant fashion. They're an interesting team with Christian Eriksen. Kasper Schmeichel's in goals, but there's not a lot of huge names in that Denmark team, but they seem like a really good, competitive, attack-minded collective.
Yeah, they're a proper team. I mean, I'd probably put them in this World Cup in the top 16, probably anywhere between, you know, 14, 13, 14, and 16. So they're not going to win the World Cup, but they are a team that on their day could make the last eight, but also could be eliminated in the group phase.
Mm. And, of course, there's Peru also. And people say they're unknown, but they did play the 2 games against New Zealand, so we had a little bit of a look at them. They're a team that hadn't qualified for the World Cup in 36 years, I believe. They've got an Argentinian coach. Their star striker is fighting a drug ban at the moment. And also Jefferson Farfan, the guy who's almost like the Tim Cahill of Peruvian football, 33-year-old, played about 70 games.
He'd be happy if Tim was only 33.
But he's a guy that they go to every now and again to try and get that winner for them, and he ended up scoring a goal in the second leg against New Zealand. So they're a little bit unknown, but they're 11th in the world, so they must have something going for them.
Yeah, but that's the world rankings. I mean, Poland, do we seriously think Poland are in the top 10 teams in the world? you can jiggle those rankings. Poland don't play any friendly.
Yeah.
And or apparently that's how they've done it to get themselves seeded very highly. They played almost no friendlies, just competitive games, top their group, so they look good. I mean, I'm not suggesting Peru don't play friendlies, but well, they probably don't have time given the level of intensity that the South American CONMEBOL qualifiers are in 18 games. Look, any team that qualifies out of South America, you've probably got to say it. Most of them are top 20, and most of them are probably, you know, top 16. Just to get out of Latin America is very, very difficult. I mean, there are a handful of nations who've managed it, Ecuador, and then never do anything. They tend to qualify because of, various advantages they've got, like playing at altitude. But you know, Peru have got some pedigree, albeit, you know, 70s and 80s. I didn't actually see much of their game against New Zealand. I wonder if they might underestimate Australia.
Yeah, I think they'll back themselves. It just sounds like from me doing a few interviews around this and reading a bit about Peru, they're just a real spirited team that got a bit of momentum up. They weren't going so well early in the qualifying series and just really scraped through ahead of Chile on that last game. And if it wasn't for an indirect free kick they took and the opposition goalkeeper got their hand to it, which obviously allowed the goal, because if he didn't touch it, it wouldn't have been in. They wouldn't have qualified through at all. So there was a bit of luck involved.
Yeah, but, you know, ifs, buts, maybes. If the Syrian free kick had hit the post and gone in instead of out, Australia wouldn't have got past the first leg. I mean, these are, you know, these are the tiny margins, the fractions upon which games turn. And what makes football in so many ways so different to other team sports where, you know, possession of the ball almost entirely guarantees you a win. These things can turn games. And I suspect, you know, teams get where they should get in the end. Going back to Denmark, I was in Copenhagen, three, 4 years ago, Australia played a friendly in Copenhagen against the Danes. I think it was a draw from memory, 0-0, 1-1, something like that. You know, I don't know how many of that side are still there, probably some of them. Simon Jahr, I think, the captain, was playing that day. And, of course, Lord Bentner, I think, he was around then. I don't know if he's going to be about now. Is he still in the squad?
Yeah, he's still in the squad, would you believe? And I was talking to Thomas Sorensen about this yesterday. And
Sorensen might have played in that game, I don't know.
Yeah, well, he was, I think, the last time he played in the 2010 World Cup, I think, Thomas Sorensen. So, yeah. Nicholas Bentner is a very interesting case because I think he's playing in Norway at the moment, but he's a guy that obviously is sublimely talented, but who knows, you know, why he sort of never really got the best out of himself at Arsenal and other clubs, and maybe it's his temperament or whatever. But Thomas Sorensen said yesterday that the pundits in Denmark are hoping that it'll all come together with maturity with that guy. So still thinking big things about him. He's still in the squad there. But, you know, when you look at Denmark, you look at the pedigree. You mentioned pedigree. You know, you think back to 86, that wonderful team that took all before them in the group stage and then got hammered by Spain, I think 6-1 in the playoff. In the sudden death angle. And then you look at Peru. You know, the 78 team was just a wonderful team in Argentina that, you know, I think they beat Scotland and they drew with Holland in that thing. So you just remember back to those days about the pedigree in these national teams and what almost goes wrong about that golden generation that doesn't quite come through again for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know what happens there. I mean, the Danes in 86, as you say, were sensational. You know, the fans chanted, "We are red, we are white, we're Danish dynamite." It sounds so naive now, doesn't it? But, you know, they had that fantastic side, Thorin Lerby and Jan Molby and Preben Elkjær and Laudrup.
Jesper Olsen was
in there. You know, terrific, terrific team, but absolutely destroyed. Didn't Emilio Butragueño get 4 goals in that game for Spain? What happened? Well, they won the Euros, you know, sort of 4 years later. Remember when they sensationally came off the beach because the Balkans War was taking place and Yugoslavia were thrown out and the Danes were invited in and ended up winning it. And, you know, they got to, was it 98 World Cup? They made the last 8 or something, you know. I mean, they've always been thereabouts and without ever looking like real winners. As I said, I mean, they're the sort of team that could make the last 8 this time or go out in the group stage.
Yeah. I had a great chat with Luke Casserly yesterday, the head of performance there at the FFA. Of course, he was at the draw, and I actually asked him, I didn't expect him to really answer the question, but or just skirt around it, but I asked him whether the teams that we drew will also impact the coach they might sign for the new Socceroo job. And he said that if they're thinking short term, and obviously this hasn't been, you know, sort of confirmed yet in their own minds, but if they're going short term, it will impact, obviously, the whoever gets the job. And if they're thinking long term, it might not. So it's really interesting that they might have two options here as far as who they appoint as the next Socceroo coach.
Well, yeah, I mean, if they're thinking short term, just as a sugar hit, you know, obviously somebody like Bielsa would know very well about the Latin American teams, and he's also been coaching Lille in France. Have you been sacked yet? You know, so he might be knowledgeable enough. But, you know, most of these guys at the top level, they're either got quite a good knowledge bank already, or they've got 9 months, you know, 7 months, sorry, to research it. Mm. I mean, you know, you can, and don't forget the backroom staff are still in situ. You know, your Luke Casley's still there, and Ante Milicic is still there, and all these other people who are probably already have done plenty of the research anyway, and are doing it now. So whoever comes in, he's going to have a body of knowledge to work with. But of course, they're going to have their own ideas.
Yeah, of course. So there was a talk yesterday. A new name popped up in Laurent Blanc, the French legendary footballer who's coached around the traps at different places. Would it be handy having someone like him, given that we've got to play France?
Well, yeah. I mean, Blanc's you know, terrific pedigree in the great game, great footballer, PSG coach, France. Did he coach France? No, he didn't, did he? No, Didier Deschamps? Did he coach France or Deschamps? I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm not sure, mate.
But again, you know, a terrific name.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, I could go out now and just go and make up 10 names, couldn't I? And just write a story.
Yeah,
saying,
absolutely.
Oh, this bloke may be, you know, interested because somebody said on Twitter. I mean, I don't know how serious some of these candidates are. Laurent Blanc may be a serious candidate, but you could pretty much at this point, because the FFA are saying nothing or very little, and nobody's come out publicly and declared their candidature, have they? Is there a story with quotes from Blanc saying he's interested?
No, I don't think you find any. I mean, obviously, Jürgen Klinsmann's been linked to it also.
Yeah.
And
one of Klinsmann's mates rang up a bloke he knows in Australia who'd been in Germany and sounded out. Well, fair enough. That's what you do. But, you know, he's just one of, you know, as I said, I mean, you could have said any of those English coaches who was out of work, Pardew or Allardyce, before they got their premiership jobs. You could have written a story linking them with the job, couldn't you? I mean, it's obviously going to happen. We live in a world now where everybody gossips. Everybody used to gossip just as much. The difference now is that the gossip can be heard around the world, not just in the saloon bar. Mm. But, you know, as journalists, I mean, yes, we can retail all those rumours and it's great for clickbait and fantastic. And it stimulates debate and discussion. Whether it's true or not, who knows?
Lynch, let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to get your view on the fallout of the Congress last week. You've written a couple of articles since then. I want to go through those here on The Journos with Michael Lynch from The Age and The Sydney Morning Herald on FNR Football Nation Radio. More after the break.
FNR Football Nation Radio. The Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and The Age's Michael Lynch on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Across Australia, this is FNR Football Nation Radio. It is The Journos with Michael Lynch from The Age and The Sydney Morning Herald. Of course, you can join in the conversation anytime and win big. The traditional premium pack Panettone from Ital is up for grabs for the best caller, best SMSer. Just join in the conversation anytime in our live shows today. 9944 9999. That's 9944 9999. 03 in front of that if you're outside Victoria, plus 613 if you're overseas. You can also SMS us your thoughts and comments on 0428 933 345. Now, Lynchy, of course, last week, I'm not sure what stage we're at in our political mess after the AGM. We had Stephen Lowy come out and give a pretty belligerent sort of press conference attacking those people who voted the FFA resolution down, saying that they're into only money and power and they're wanting the sport to go back to the bad old days. What was your view on the reaction of Stephen Lowy after the AGM last week?
Well, I was wondering, kettle pot, black calling. I mean, here's the scion of Australia's richest family talking about money and a man who seems intent on holding on to his position irrespective of whatever happens talking about power. So maybe it takes one to know one. I think it's a very difficult position for Stephen Lowy, and I think his comments after the Congress, while obviously heartfelt, and he was very disappointed and bitter and angry. That's how he came across. Probably haven't done him any harm, because even if there was a tiny chance of some kind of rapprochement and coming together of the warring parties, I think the kind of things he said about the people concerned and about basically old football and old soccer fans, who this game has still got some way to reconnect with a lot of the people alienated 10 and 12 years ago, I think the sort of those kind of remarks just drive the wedges still further, don't they?
Absolutely. And then, Lynchy, what was he referring to going back to the bad old days? Certainly the landscape's changed. I mean, if you're talking about, giving more power to the club, suddenly we're going to be turning it into the old NSL, which is an amateur competition almost, or part-time competition. It actually bred some fantastic players, and we had some great quality football play.
Better players than we got now.
Absolutely. But the way the game was run at the time, it was run by part-time people, and there was no full-time people running the game in those days. And if you're going to put that sort of resource into something, of course they're going to be problems. But these days, you walk into the Melbourne Victory or Melbourne City or, some of the bigger clubs, Western City, there's 20 or 30 full-time people working in those places. So they're actually running them like a proper industry, the football industry these days. It's a proper football business, and surely given more power to the clubs or more say to the clubs or the autonomy, it's not taking back to the bad old days. It's just maybe giving clubs the incentive to actually invest more in marketing and pushing the club a bit further.
Well, there's a couple of points on this. Firstly, there seems to be this idea that the clubs now want to take over the entire game. My understanding is they don't. The clubs want a separate organisation with virtual autonomy to run, direct, market, sell, promote, generate revenue, improve cash flow, and financial picture for the league. Now, are they going to be capable of doing this? That's a moot point. They think they are, and I think the way that relations are now so fractured, that is going to have to be part of the solution. The second thing about this is if the Lowy family, which has, controlled the game itself, I mean, yes, there's a board, and yes, there's all sorts of people working for it, but basically what Frank Lowy wanted, Frank Lowy got, and I think Stephen has more or less kind of operated in a similar vein. They have constantly ignored various recommendations from government. The Crawford Report of 2003, actually call for the creation of an independent body to oversee and run the A-League. That was steadfastly ignored by the Frank Lowy-led administration. In 2011, the Australian Sports Commission produced the Smith Report, which was the former Howard government cabinet minister, Warwick Smith, oversaw that. And again, a very, very significant recommendation in that report was that you had to spin the A-League off and allow the clubs a fair degree of sovereignty and control of their own destinies by setting up a separate organisation to run the league. Again, Frank Lowy ignored that as well. I mean, the message from head office all the time was, we know best, we know how to generate the most money to get the most dividends to underpin the financial structure of the game. Now, that's all well and good, except you get to a point where the clubs increasingly feel that while they generate most of the revenue, they're not getting sufficient of the reward. Now, that kind of, daddy knows best approach can work while everything's going well. But it hasn't been going well, has it, financially, for several years now. And the clubs, I think, are probably at a position where they think, right, well, this lot are not generating sufficient revenue, or we're not getting enough of the pie to merit the contribution we're making. They're using the money we make to generate on large executive salaries, which I think people at the FFA appear to be very well paid, and also spending loads more on national teams than they need to spend, and that's part of the kind of wretched. I mean, if Frank Lowy had probably acquiesced initially to the Crawford Report and even later to the Smith Report, this situation may not have occurred. We may well have had independent, autonomous A-League company running the organisation, and who knows, if they'd made a sow's ear of it, a pig's ear of it, they may be the ones coming running to the FFA asking to be taken under the umbrella of the governing body. But we'll never know, because the provisions of the way that the game was set out to be, or the recommendations for the way the game was set out to be, were never adhered to.
And, of course, these owners, I think the last figure I saw, they've collectively lost $350 million, you know, over the journey of the A-League. So that's further exacerbated the need or their want to get more control about what's going on. Because, like you said, if it was going well, there wouldn't be any arguments, but things aren't going well. And really, you don't have to be a real student of the game to know that there's so much wrong at the moment by way of marketing and promotion of the league and what the owners are getting from it. It's really, really difficult for them to really be inspired to take it to the next level. But
it's going to be a tough task. Mm. And, you know, even if they do get their wish and run the game or run the league for themselves, I mean, and who's to say or know what kind of league they want to run and create, you know? I mean, it's possible they say they want to extend the competition and have expansion eventually leading up to 16. That's fantastic. But is there also a situation where, you know, their first and primary concern will be to actually increase the value of the franchises? So what are the ramifications of that? Does it mean we cap the league at 12, 14, 16 teams? Will there be promotion relegation? I mean, you know, it's an exciting future, but it's one that's still got to be fully explained.
Well, a lot of other countries have gone through this transition. Lynchy, I think we can learn a lot from, you know, I think it was someone's talking to me about Germany the other day. They went through this transition. I think Dave Davidovic was talking about Germany, how they were going quite poorly in a couple of World Cups, according to their, you know, their expectations. I mean, quarterfinals and semi-final losses were failures for them.
In 2000, when they got eliminated in the group stage.
Absolutely,
in the Euros. That was the kind of big, can we say, Kulturkampf, use a phrase from 19th century Germany. It was the big sort of cultural change point in their football that they went back to basics and grassroots then.
Absolutely, and look what they've got now. It's just a powerhouse in football. And really, you know, we talk about the Dutch and who we should be emulating. I just think if we're going to emulate or take something from a culture of football, the German culture, for me, would be the way to go, given that they're a Western country, a wealthy Western country, where their kids can be distracted with all sorts of things, but they still play their football, still have elite teams coming through at all levels, and they seem to have got their Bundesliga right as an independent league that is member-based, with member-based clubs that's thriving, basically. There's no reason why we can't look at that and learn from that.
I think Australia's in a perfect position to not model itself on anyone at all, just cherry-pick a bit. Yeah. And but fundamentally create an Australianness, you know. Now, that may be 2 16-team divisions, A and B league promotion relegation. It may not. You know what it may be? It may be a strong regional leagues, professional football in strong regional leagues with a Champions League format at the end to determine who the champions are. It may be 2 conferences of, you know, 14 teams each, and the conference champions play off in the final at the end of the season to determine who the Australian champions are. You know, there's a lot of models that, you know, once we're freed up, if it's freed up from the current situation of management, there can be a lot of more creative thinking perhaps brought to bear. The issue is always going to be money, and is there money to support teams and professional teams? Well, the naysayers say no, there isn't, and it will be a disaster if we break away and leave everything as it is. And that's a point of view. But my point of view tends to be, if you don't know, if you don't try, you don't know. And if something fails, well, do it again and fail better. Yeah. You know, eventually. And, you know, people seem to want it to be perfect straight away. People forget the leagues that we look at in Europe and admire and around the world. They took 30, 40 years, some of them 50 years. I mean, the Bundesliga didn't even come into being until the mid to late 60s.
Yeah.
German football was regionalised until then, you know. So this game here, as in its current iteration, is only 10 or 12 or 15 years old, this league. I mean, you know, there's got to be a long-term view. And if clubs fail and fall over, well, other ones will come and replace them. That's my view. Will that be a PR disaster? It'll be a short term hit, but it won't be a disaster for the game if the game is still attractive and entertaining. And if there isn't sufficient money in the sport to support the way that we all want it to be, well, we have to be realistic then and accept that maybe we do have to have, you know, less ambitious targets. Maybe the players won't be able to earn as much money. I mean, you know, everything's there to be shaken out still.
Now, of course, Lynchy, the FIFA Member Associations Committee is meeting. I believe they might have a sort of decision this morning sometime, Australian time, about the extent to which they might step in with this normalisation process, where they still work with the Lowy board or where they wipe that board and start with someone else. Now, you wrote a really interesting article where Football Federation Victoria, a proposal by them, could buy FFA chairman Stephen Lowy more time. What was that all about?
Well, that was a letter written on the 29th of November, the day before the Congress, and signed by Kim Ontaliadoros, the chairman of FFB, to the clubs. It was a response to something that the clubs had written earlier in the week, where the clubs, there was last week, there was supposed to be, or they were hoping to set up a meeting last Monday, i.e. 3 days before the Congress, of all the interested parties to try and hammer out a solution so we didn't get blood on the floor at the Thursday Congress. Several of the parties and member states were keen to go to this meeting. I think the FFA were happy to be represented there, but the clubs said, no, we're not going unless the FFA withdraw all their contentious motions and we can debate about a proper, you know, tabula rasa, if you like, a proper kind of way in which we can go about this for Thursday's Congress. And the FFA said, no, we're not withdrawing any of our motions. Well, you know, there you go, immovable object and irresistible force. So the clubs wouldn't go. But Kim Ontaliadoros, as a result, wrote to the clubs and suggested that they hadn't acted in good faith and that, that Football Victoria still believed and hoped there was time for mediation and that the FFE would propose a further two-week period of mediation, even if FIFA was, or the AFC were in control and doing that. Now, that letter was written dated the day before Congress. Obviously, in the air, but the FFB board were adamant that they weren't going to support Lowy. Now, when it push came to shove, the FFB delegate at Congress did vote alongside the clubs and alongside Football New South Wales and ended up denying Lowy the numbers he needed, hence the belligerent post-Congress press conference. But it's an interesting one because there is a school of thought that suggests Stephen Lowy may now be able to go to FIFA and say, well, look, yes, I got role, but hold on, here's one of our people who voted against us. One of our enemies, if you like, still saying there's not that much between us and can we have more time to negotiate? So it was either by design or by happenstance, but it may have presented him with some kind of, you know, legitimacy to go and ask for a further period to negotiate. FIFA, of course, may just say, sorry, mate, no, even if that's the case, you still haven't got consensus. The PFA don't agree with you. The clubs don't agree with you. You've only got, and two of your federations don't agree. So, sorry, no amount of special pleading is going to change our mind. They may take that view. But they may take the view that, well, rather than go through the drama of normalisation, let's give them another 2 weeks, 10 days, and see if they can hammer something out. My feeling is that it'll be impossible because the bad blood now between the clubs, well, the professional game and the Lowys and Stephen Lowy is so great that I can't see any kind of compromise. I mean, I wouldn't say it's impossible because in the end, everyone has a price or agreements, improbable as they may seem, can sometimes be stitched up. But on the surface, you'd have to say, wouldn't you, that relationships are so negative. And those things that Lowy has said after the Congress hardly will endear him and provide a platform for some kind of, friendship again, will they? You know, so I can't see a solution here other than in some way the league has to be spun off and more or less given complete autonomy, and maybe Lowy has to go to provide peace. I don't know.
His response in that press conference after his failure to get the required votes in the AGM, it seemed like a bloke who had something up his sleeve. He was on the attack, and it just seemed like maybe he's relying on his relationships with FIFA. You know, it's been reported that he, you know, travelled there a few times in the last 6 months, obviously putting his case in behind closed doors there, I think at times without the knowledge of other stakeholders. And they say that he's got a very, very close relationship with the head of FIFA there at the moment, Infantino. So maybe he's relying on something like that to give him more time too.
He's right in the sense it is about money and power. Yeah, it's absolutely about that. And you know, he's a moneyed up, cashed up bloke who's used to exercising power, and he's going to fight to do that, and he's going to use the weapons at his disposal to do it. And if that's pulling in favours from Infantino, he'll do that if he can. Is that going to be sufficient? Who knows? Well, I mean, it's an interesting. If the normalisation committee comes in and just wipes away Lowy and the rest of the board, puts the Committee of the Great and the Good in for a few months until such times as a new chairman and board are elected. That's one thing. I think people will sort of shrug their shoulders and go, yeah, OK, well, we saw that coming. If somehow Stephen Lowy managed to retain power, I think we'd get an even worse civil war, though, wouldn't we? Because the clubs would then be backed into a corner. Having challenged him thus far, they would probably say, well, you know, we're as far sort of steeped in blood now. We might as well just keep carrying on. And that would then perhaps produce an Armageddon. Would they break away? But if they broke away in those circumstances and against the chairman who had FIFA's backing, that would then probably put the game into disrepute here outside all of the FIFA statutes. Would Australia then be, you know, sort of punished by FIFA as a result of that? I don't know. It's a high-stakes game here. I mean, someone did tell me that Stephen's negotiating tactic is to push it right to the edge and call people's bluff. And maybe that's what he's doing now, you know, but maybe the clubs have called his bluff too.
Lynchy, let's leave that behind and let's talk A-League. Of course, it was a round of interesting round of A-League games on the weekend, and unfortunately all this stuff is taking the focus off it, but some really interesting matchups. Adelaide United, of course, on Friday night up against Sydney FC. 1-0 win by Sydney. It wasn't a champagne performance by then. I know Marco Kurz is very frustrated by the fact they didn't get anything out of that game, Adelaide United. It was a replay of the FFA Cup final. Sydney just seem to be doing it quite comfortably at the moment, even if they're not playing well.
Well, isn't that the hallmark of a good side? We always say, don't we? You can pick up 3 points and win a game, just do enough by not necessarily playing all that well. And they are obviously the benchmark in the game here, you know. Highly efficient, very well organised defensively, have sufficient creativity and potency in forward areas to take their chances, and when they get in front, sort of lock the game down. You know, they're a bit like a kind of classical old Italian team in that sense, aren't they? You know, when I was a kid growing up, that's what your Inters and your Milans used to do in the 70s, shut games down, nick a goal, and then it was all over.
Yeah, who's the Facchetti of the team?
I don't know if Facchetti of the team. Would that be Wilkinson, maybe?
No, I'm not sure. I don't think there's any Facchetti. Probably Giacomo LaRocca, if he was playing for Sydney, would be that Facchetti type. But Dad used to always talk to me about that Inter Milan side of the 60s, and they're all monster defenders, and they were about six of them in the back almost in the back line. They play with a back six, and they just the old Catenaccio system.
I'm a bit too young to actually remember those teams of the early 60s. I became a teenager in the 70s, but I mean, I read my history and saw the old film clips when I was a teenager, and you know, Facchetti and the Helenio Herrera.
That's right.
Was the coach, the Argentinian, wasn't he? And I do remember watching in grainy black and white when I was about 9 or 10, Celtic beating that Inter team in the European Cup final in 67. And we all thought, I think Inter scored early.
Yeah.
Mazzola. And we all thought, that's it. We're going to have 80 minutes of boredom now. And that's kind of what it was. Celtic just attacking wave after wave until they actually scored too late, I think, to beat them. But, great memories. And I'm not suggesting Sydney are anywhere near that level. Of course they're not. Of course they're not, but there is a kind of stylistic similarity, isn't there?
Absolutely, and of course, on the Saturday, Western Sydney Wanderers versus Brisbane Roar, a 2-0 away win by Brisbane Roar in Western Sydney. A lot of criticism around Josip Gombau, and not so much his appointment, but his approach trying to change the style of play for Western Sydney, in the middle of a season. I think the players are struggling with it, probably asking questions about what was wrong with the way we were playing before, because I thought they started the season well, even though Tony Popovich wasn't around to start the season with them. I thought they played some pretty good stuff, but they just seem like a team that's just uncertain and maybe lacking a bit of faith in what the coach wants them to do at the moment.
Oh, hold on. I mean, you know, didn't anyone read the tin? Of course Gombau was going to come in and change things. I presume that's why they appointed him, because they wanted him to galvanise the squad, shake it up, change the playing style and lay down a template for the Wanderers of the future. He's got to start at some time. He might as well start when he arrives. What would have been the point in just basically saying, all right, Foxy, you've done okay. Just carry on. You really coach it. I'll just be the nominal head coach and I'll just watch for the rest of this season and then I'll change everything in the off-season. I mean, there wouldn't have been any point in that. So, of course, Gombau's going to try and change things as soon as he comes in. I mean, there's a lot of criticism about his body language, wasn't there, and the animation or lack thereof. Or the commitment of the players. But the club have hired him. He's only been there, a fortnight, 3 weeks. The players have got to react. I mean, if not, the coach will drop them and find other players.
And, of course, Brisbane Roar are getting the away win. They've been obviously inconsistent this year, but it was great to see Ivan Franich. I'm not sure about the hairstyle, the colour in the top of the head there, but certainly the goal was top-notch, and it's good to see him playing well again.
Sonny, who was it? Was it Macaroni's volley? Macaroni's shot, Ivan only been on the pitch a matter of seconds, hadn't he? Yeah, great, stunning finish, and you could see exactly he meant to do it. And interesting, on his left foot. I mean, a boy who's always played on the right. So, good, great technique, he might not be out of the World Cup conversation. If he could have a really good sort of 3 months. I mean, if Ange was still the coach, I suspect he'd be very much in the World Cup conversation if he had a good second half of the A-League season. But even if he Ange isn't there, as he isn't. If Franich was to have a good, 7 or 8 out of 10 in every game for the next 15 rounds, well, he might well force his way back into World Cup calculations.
And especially if the new coach wants to play a back four with a traditional attacking full back, he fits that role beautifully. On Saturday night, of course, Newcastle Jets at home lost to Melbourne City. They talk about game of two halves. I thought Newcastle absolutely dominated that first half. Got to the point where I think Luke Bratton was having a crack at his coach, Warren Joyce, on the field. They're having arguments left, right, and centre. But in the end, there must be some spirit in that Melbourne City team because they came from behind. And Matty Muscat, a guy who's really underrated. You look at Matty and no one really takes him all that seriously. But wherever he goes, he gets game time and coaches respect him.
Yeah, I think he's a good professional, very good professional. And he's coachable. and he'll play, you know, wherever the coach wants him to play, central, right, left. He's sort of done it all. You know, many wouldn't pretend he's the best player ever, but he does a job. He's exactly what title-winning squads, if they are to challenge for the title, need. Players like him who can be in and out of the team without complaining and can play in a variety of roles and achieve a reasonably consistent level of performance. And, you know, he got a reward in the rain on Saturday night. I mean, it was a very different second-half performance, as you said, from City. And Joyce is very big now on culture and changing the culture and, you know, bringing in the right sort of people who will adopt the philosophy that they want to adopt. And I think that strong team spirit is part of that. And, you know, Manny got his goal. It was his first goal for the club, actually. And the Ross McCormack, you know, I mean, that's six goals now for Ross McCormack. I mean, none of them from open play, which is quite a fantastic statistic. But I don't know if I've ever seen a ball hit harder for a penalty. I mean, I don't think it would have mattered if the keeper had got right full body behind it. He would have just gone in the net.
Absolutely.
He really well he did, didn't he?
And of course, Newcastle Jets have got their own personnel issues at the moment. Ernie brought in a number of young players who, again, they showed a really great brand of football in that first half. But in the end, he felt the inexperience almost caught up with him by the end of that game.
Yeah, well, I mean, this happens. But every club has got injury issues and problems. I mean, you forget, you know, Melbourne City have been without Fernando Brandão and Bruno Fornaroli all season. I mean, you take Fornaroli was virtually the best player in the league, wasn't he?
Yeah.
You know, a couple of seasons ago when he scored 25 goals in debut season, there wouldn't have been a better player in the league, really. Maybe he didn't win the Warren Medal. That was, what's his name?
Diego
Castro.
Yeah.
Just nutted him out. But, you know, if you took Thomas Broich out of that Brisbane team when it was going well for an entire season, would they have been anywhere near as threatening? Probably not. And that's kind of what City are doing here without Fornaroli. You know, if you took Berisha out of victory for the whole season, would they be anywhere near as potent? Probably not. So, you know, and so Ernie's got his issues. Obviously, Roy O'Donovan missing and Vargas. Yeah, but all the teams have got to deal with this.
Absolutely. And, of course, you mentioned Berisha and, you know, after going 2-0 down in Wellington, victory, you know, it's amazing. When they get it going, they're as good as they've ever been under Muscat, but they're just doing consistently enough and they're getting punished for every possible mistake. And Kalajurovic's goals for Wellington to get them 2-0 up, you thought, oh, no, it's going to happen again and suddenly real pressure will be exacted on Kevin Muscat. But they came back 3-2 winners in the end and everyone's waiting for that win that's going to kickstart their season. We thought that was going to be the win against Perth a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, how do you read Melbourne victory at the moment? Is it just a lack of fortune in the way they're playing, or is there something a little bit more, you know, embedded in that team that's not allowing them to play consistent football?
Well, I think there's a couple of things with it. I think it is very... People have forgotten how disruptive this opening 8 weeks of the season has been for them. I mean, they virtually not had Milligan, Troisi and Barbarousis for most of it, because even on the times they've been back and available, they haven't been able to train properly. They haven't been part of a cohesive build-up for you know, in the pre-games and had a run of games together with their teammates. So I think all that travel, I mean, Australia had four World Cup games, the Saudi New Zealand, didn't they, in that 8 week period, players away on camp and then just knackered after travelling and coming back and not being part of the build up to victory. It's almost like the season is only just starting for them with those three players now. And I think that has had a big impact on their consistency. I mean, I do think their personnel is aged. I think their midfield is, you know, like their key players are old. Like Valeri's 32. They're all on the wrong side of 32.
Yeah.
Milligan, Berisha and Valeri. And, you know, these things are issues. That can they run the game out as well or as quickly. I mean, Carl's lost his pace. We all know that. Not that he was never the flash anyway, was he? You know, but he's been exposed a bit sometimes for speed. Milligan is a box to box player, but you know he's not getting any younger. And probably that sort of area of the team is the one where you might start asking question marks, not on the quality of the players concerned, but just on their ability to run out a long season. Do I think they'll recover? Well, they're up to six now. Yeah, I think they'll definitely, you know, be in the finals. They might and make top four, but it's very hard to see them overhauling Sydney or getting anywhere close, is it?
Now, Maddie, we've got one minute to go, mate. I just want to talk about one thing with the Central Coast Mariners 1-0 win over Perth. Danny De Silva's assist for the Blake Powell goal.
Yeah, great, wasn't it? Terrific. Mm. I mean, sort of picked it up, ran, played the 2-1 wall passes, cut back, got a goal. Yeah, look, he's another kid who... And he was in Socceroos squads under Postecoglou, at least they had a sniff of him, didn't they, you know? And he's another boy who, if he has a really strong finish to the A-League season and plays like that every week, he'd have to put himself in the conversation. I mean, that's the thing. With a new coach now, you know, a lot of players who might have thought they were no hope will get a spring in their step, and some players who probably thought, I'm a lock here, may start looking nervously over their shoulders at whoever replaces. Not all of them. We all know that there's a core of players who are definitely going to go to the World Cup, but there'll be a handful of them who've been in Andrew's squads who'll be thinking, oh, am I a certainty now? I probably would be if Andrew's still here, but not sure now.
We'll just have to wait and see, Lynchy. Thanks for joining us today, mate. Enjoyable chat as always, and we'll speak to you again next Tuesday.
Indeed.
Good on you, mate. That's Michael Lynch, the legendary Michael Lynch from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Joins us every Tuesday here on the Journos on FNR Football Nation Radio. That brings an end to the Journos for today. Of course, you can podcast the show on SoundCloud and iTunes. So until this time tomorrow with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia, may you have a great day in football.
For your fill of the latest World Cup news and interviews, join me, Adriano Del Monte, on The Road to Russia, Tuesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, on your voice of football, FNR, Football Nation Radio.